Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg on a Tuesday.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
That was real.
Just kicking off the cobwebs. Coming up on the show, there's a lot of new research about how to get a good night's rest. We're digging through it all with Dr. Philip Gearman, a sleep medicine expert at the University of Pennsylvania. And of course, as always, we want to hear from you. If you've ever struggled to fall asleep, or maybe you found something that works for you, give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. Or email us, studio2@whyy.org.
And I'm working off just four or five myself, so I'm looking forward to that segment. Also, this hour, we'll enjoy an exclusive live performance by legendary trombonist and Philly native Jeff Bradshaw. That will be our very first live music performance on this program.
Very exciting. Looking forward to that. Live music on the radio.
Exactly. We're also streaming it live on Instagram. Follow at WHYY. Another first for us. So that's later in the show. But before we get to that, we've got to jump right into some of the stories that caught our eye, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
start us off, Cherry.
Yeah. The official state, we're talking about official state beverages. In Pennsylvania and in Delaware, that beverage is milk. But New Jersey has never designated an official beverage. But thanks to middle schoolers and sentiments in New Jersey, cranberry juice may finally get its due. Do you like cranberry juice?
It's all right.
It's all right. Yeah.
It's not a top juice. Yeah. I'm not going to lie. It's not a top juice for me.
Yeah. But a 2020 lesson about state symbols inspired a classroom of then fourth graders at Eleanor Rush Intermediate School to investigate what makes a good official state beverage. And in New Jercy, the Lenape people were the very first to grow and use the cranberry. And the state is now the third largest cranberry producer in the United States. The students started lobbying legislators in Trenton, writing letters. They took a trip to the Capitol. They made their case. And at first, the bill never made it to the floor, but it was reintroduced. And now it has passed unanimously. Governor Murphy will have 45 days to sign it into law.
Pretty cool. I then went down a rabbit hole once I saw this story on the rundown of state's official beverages.
Mm-hmm.
Tons of them are milk. Which makes me think at some point the dairy lobby was like trying to get
states to
like name milk as their official beverage. There are a few that don't have milk though, so New Jersey hopefully will be one of them soon. Florida, you could probably guess
orange juice.
Maine has a soda beverage called Moxie, which I think is big in New England. I've never had it. Only one state has water, and it is Indiana.
Wow.
Back to basics, Indiana.
We gotta mention the juices that did not make the cut. Tomato juice, I understand why. And blueberry juice.
I actually like tomato juice.
Really?
I know that makes me weird. I do like tomato juice.
Okay.
It's especially on a flight.
It's refreshing? Were you going to say tomato juice? It's refreshing.
It's refreshing. Yeah, and it makes you feel good about yourself. But I hope cranberry juice is the state beverage for the sake of the kids in New Jersey. Moving from Trenton now to the Jersey Shore. So we're coming up on Memorial Day, which is the unofficial / official opening of shore season. And we're opening this season with some unnerving news. There was a teenager who was surfing down in Stone Harbor the other day and got attacked by what is believed to be a shark. Good news, this 15-year-old fought off the shark, kicking and screaming, which apparently is what you're supposed to do if a shark gets a hold of your leg. And the wounds are relatively minor, 6 stitches. She's on crutches. So thank God she's okay, but not a super fun way to start the shore season with this shark attack.
She's pretty brave, I have to say that. Shout out.
I would have freaked out.
Yeah, I would have totally freaked out. And I got to say, this is pretty rare. There have only been 25 unprovoked shark attacks in New Jersey since the late 1800s. The chance of it happening is about 1 in 11 million. So swim and enjoy life, you know, if you're going down the shore. And some of the reasons why we're seeing more sharks on northeastern shores, according to marine experts, is likely linked to climate change, like so many other things.
You're right. It is super rare.
Yeah.
And I feel like you have to emphasize that. I never know if we should even mention stories like this because it gives people maybe a false impression that this stuff happens all the time. But it's more being remarked upon because it is remarkable. Like, this stuff does not happen very often down in the Jersey Shore. As you mentioned, historically, it's happened just a handful of times.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind, please.
And enjoy the shore.
Please enjoy the shore.
And get in the water, man. So imagine, like, how do you feel, Avi, when you find like a crumpled 20 and those washed jeans? I feel great.
If that had ever happened to me, I would feel great about it.
Exactly.
I don't remember it ever happening.
Well, apparently that could happen to a lot of us because Pennsylvania is sitting on billions of dollars of unclaimed property. But the good news is they're planning on making it easier to send it back to you. Right now, the Commonwealth has about $4 billion in unclaimed funds. These are uncashed checks, tax refunds that were sent to an old address, old gift cards maybe you didn't spend, you know, insurance refunds, all of this. The way it works now, you have to ask for that money back,
right?
But Pennsylvania Treasurer Stacey Garrity wants to adopt the proactive system in which the state sends the money directly to the people who have the unclaimed property. So you would get a check in the mail for like $100 and you'd be like, ooh, lottery.
They wouldn't have to do anything.
You wouldn't have to do anything.
Right. Sounds good.
That bill has been introduced in the state Senate. It was voted out of the Finance Committee in early May with unanimous support. So it has momentum there. And I should note that Pennsylvania didn't even require financial institutions to notify people before they sent their money to the state until 2016. And by the way, I have some money coming to me. So
yeah, you went on the website.
Yes, I did. Looked,
and you apparently have some money.
$100.
$100 of unclaimed money. That's cool. I hope we could, hopefully we can get that link like on our website or Studio 2 webpage. And so people, before they pass this change, can go and click on the link and see if there is something for them to request. I think it would be the first time people started rushing to our Studio 2 webpage.
I know. Give them a reason. And by the way, roughly 1 in 10 Pennsylvanians who miss, they have money in this fund.
Yeah, so misplaced dollars,
it may be worth it. It's on the Pennsylvania Treasury website. So you might want to check it out.
All right. Speaking of checking out, a lot of us probably checked out of the primary because it happened a week ago in Pennsylvania, but there are still things shaking out from the primary. And just recently, for instance, we learned who won the city council race in the 8th district here in Philadelphia, which is Northwest Philadelphia. It was so close that it took them nearly a week to count all the tallies and to make a projection. But the AP has called the race for the incumbent Cindy Bass, who is a Democrat. Her challenger within the party was Seth Anderson Oberman, and it was super, super close. Just a few hundred votes end up separating them, at least at this point. There's still some votes coming in, but it looks like Cindy Bass will hold on. Also yesterday, we heard from Sherelle Parker, who is the presumptive next mayor. She's the Democratic nominee, we'll put it like that.
Yeah.
And she hadn't made any public comments, at least not in a press conference forum, because she had this medical issue related to dental surgery right as the election was happening, which is crazy. But yesterday she met with Governor Josh Shapiro and she was able to hold a press conference. So we got to hear from the possible next mayor.
Yeah, and she talked about unifying Philadelphians. Mm-hmm. And she said she was going to work to earn the votes of, you know, the party and members of the party and the city. So she has a lot of work. But I wanted to comment on that razor thin margin. It's like just 400 plus votes
in the eighth district.
And I have to say, I talked to a lot of different voters and they said, you know, that, you know, Councilwoman Bass has some work to do. She has to, you know, kind of bring her district together, do some listening maybe. And because you don't want in 4 years this to happen again and the outcome be different. So we'll see what happens in the 8th district. We have a lot of listeners up there.
We love our 8th district listeners.
They vote. So there you go.
Yeah, it was a huge turnout, it seemed like.
Yeah.
I mean, for an off-year election, at least. Yeah.
For sure, out of the 8th district. And so speaking about elections in the future, we got a little bit of a development this week from Delaware. U.S. Senator Tom Carper says he will not run for re-election. And here he is announcing his decision yesterday at a press conference podium next to his wife, Martha.
There's ever an opportune time to step aside. It's coming. In fact, it will be here on January 3rd, 2025. But until then, God willing, I'll continue working 60-hour weeks, coming home on the train most nights, as long as this lady will keep leaving the light on for me.
Tom Carper, long-time fixture in Delaware politics. So him leaving the stage is a big deal. So joining us to talk more about it is WHYY News Senior Managing Editor Mark Eichmann. He has been covering Senator Tom Carper for 15 years, which turns out to be just a fraction of Carper's career, but it's still a long time. Mark Eichmann, welcome to Studio 2.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
All right, Tom. Tom. All right, Mark. Got Tom on my mind here. Tell us a little bit about Tom Carper. It seems like all he ever did was win elections. How long was he in office, and give us a scope of the positions that he served in?
Yeah, you said it. He was, you know, he's really been the most successful vote getter, really in Delaware history on a statewide basis. He was first elected as treasurer in 1977, and that kind of kicked off a string of successful races that continued until his last race in 2018, and now he will not run again in 2024. But, you know, there's that's not necessarily because he doesn't think he could win. He probably would have won should he have run again in 2024. That's just how successful he has been. He faced a pretty serious primary challenger, kind of the first serious challenger he saw in years in 2018 from a progressive Democrat named Carrie Evelyn Harris. There was lots of writing about whether, you know, Carper, who's sort of a, you know, moderate Democrat, was going to be vulnerable, but not at all. He won like 64% of the vote in that primary and then went on to win the general election handily over the Republican. So, yeah, super successful in campaigns and elections. You know, he's held just about every statewide office in the state. He went from treasurer, then he went to Congress through the 80s. Then he became governor for two terms. And then he won his seat in the Senate.
Mark, can you tell me why you think he was so successful? Because I've been around him a little bit, and he's not like Mr. Slick, Mr. Smooth politician guy. Like, what made him such a good politician in terms of winning?
Yeah, I think maybe that plays a role in why he was not, you know, smooth talking, slick politician. His colleague in the Senate, Senator Coons, is very, has this rhetorical flair that he speaks with, and Carper is almost the exact opposite of that, sort of very, almost every man in the way he talks. He was a very, kind of rabid campaigner. He would go all over the state of Delaware to the smallest Delaware towns in Sussex County and to the tiniest events. He would show up, you know, he famously put more than 500,000 miles on his minivan that he crossed the state in, you know, meeting people. And I think that really, you know, Delaware politics is a lot about retail politics and actually meeting people. And Carper was the kind of guy who I think connected with a lot of people because of his demeanor. And he didn't seem like that slick politician.
Wow. And so let's talk about his biggest successes. What do you think, you know, they were, given the scope of and the long time of his tenure.
Yeah, and that's a hard question to answer for all those decades, right? The president talked about it yesterday in a statement that he put out, because they worked very well together when they were both in the Senate, sharing train rides together. You know, he was on the Finance Committee when the Affordable Care Act got pushed through, and Biden gave him big credit for getting, Obamacare through when he was in as a vice president and Carper was in the Senate.
Wow.
He's also, more locally, I think one of the things he would hang his hat on is getting Delaware its first branch of the national park, which is something he pushed for. And, you know, Delaware had not had that until he was really championing that.
Wow.
So a couple of those kind of things, I think, will be his big legacy things.
And I got to mention that he, he announced in advance that he will not run, but also named his heir apparent, Lisa Blunt Rochester. He says he would endorse her if she ran. Tell us a little bit about Lisa Blunt Rochester as we wrap up.
Yeah, and Lisa formerly interned for Carper many, many years ago. So there's a long connection there. And she was elected to Congress as the first black representative, the first woman from Delaware elected to Congress in 2016. So she's got a background in government experience. She worked as a personnel director for the state. She was also she also worked elsewhere in the cabinet under Carper. She hasn't said whether she's going to run, so we're still waiting for her answer on that. But that would open up a big, so you would have Carper needing to be replaced because he's not running. If Lisa Blunt Rochester runs, her seat would open up, and it would just make for a very interesting campaign.
Well, perhaps,
next year.
And perhaps she will be senator soon. That was Mark Eichmann. Thanks so much for joining us, Mark.
My pleasure.
Mark Eichmann is the senior managing editor for WHYY News. Coming up next on Studio 2, we're talking about sleep. Give us a call. Participate. This is Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, bouncing along here to this music. Mm-hmm. Cherry, a question for you. How'd you sleep last night?
Not so well. I popped up at like 4:30 and went to bed at midnight. It's not good.
Popped up at 4:30?
I know. I didn't mean to. I wanted to go back to sleep, but I couldn't.
How did you kill the time?
Just got up and, you know, tried to do something relaxing, but it didn't work.
And it didn't work. Yeah. At what point do you give up?
When the sun comes up.
Yeah. Which these days, long days right now, that comes mm-hmm. earlier and earlier. Well, I don't know the last time I really got a true full night's sleep. I got a little infant at home. So, you know, we sleep when we can. And among our Studio 2 staff, sleep is a huge topic of conversation. In our little cove back there,
yes,
sleep and lack of sleep comes up all of the time because a lot of us, our producers included, struggle with some form of insomnia. And it turns out it's pretty common. A third of Americans are not getting the sleep they need for their health. 50 to 70 million struggle with sleep disorders.
Yeah,
that's a huge number.
Huge number. The good news is we hope to get some answers for you this afternoon. University of Pennsylvania sleep psychologist and researcher Philip Gehrman is here right now to talk with us about why a good night's rest is so hard to get. And he's bringing us some new research that once again highlights just how important sleep is for brain health. Dr. Gehrman, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you, if you are listening and you have trouble sleeping or you have questions for our expert, or maybe you have your home remedy that you want to share,
ooh,
call
yes.
in or email us. The number is 888-477-9499, or you can email studio2@whyy.org.
Okay, so let's lay the foundation, Dr. Gehrman. What exactly is a good night's sleep, and what does it do for us mm-hmm. and our bodies?
Well, that's a big question. I always say asking what sleep does is sort of like asking what wakefulness does. It's a huge mm-hmm. question. I'd say you know you've had a good night of sleep if you wake up feeling rested, restored, energized for the day, and you're able to sustain that energy level over the course of the day. So whatever sleep gives us that daytime feeling mm. is really what we're aiming for.
You always hear about these stages of sleep. Mm-hmm. You know, there's REM sleep or whatever. I mean, take us through the sleep process mm-hmm. and all the sort of mile markers we're supposed to hit over the course of a good night's sleep.
Sure. So when we fall asleep, we expect normal sleep, we consider falling asleep in around 15 to 30 minutes or less. So it's not the expectation that people are going to get into bed and immediately fall asleep. When you first fall asleep, you're in a very light sleep, what we call stage one sleep. Usually just for a few minutes, you settle into what we call stage two sleep, which I often refer to as just average sleep, not real light, not real deep. And then you settle into that good, deep, what we call stage three or slow wave sleep, which really seems to be the most restorative type of sleep that we have. We then enter a brief period of rapid eye movement or REM sleep, and then that completes one what we call a sleep cycle, which lasts about 90 minutes.
Wow, all that 90 minutes?
All of that is 90 minutes.
Okay,
yep.
So I feel like for me, I had this preconceived notion before we set up this segment that some of these chunks were like hours long in and of themselves, but that's not the case. We go through a whole cycle in 90 minutes.
In a typical night of sleep, yes.
In a typical healthy
exactly.
night of sleep. And how many times should we go through that cycle in a given night?
So typically around 5 to 6 sleep cycles over the course of the night, give or take, a couple, because since they're 90 minutes on average, some are going to be shorter, some are going to be longer. And then those sleep cycles in the early part of the night are really dominated by that deep N3, stage 3 sleep. But then over the course of the night with each cycle, we have less and less of that deep sleep and more of the REM sleep. So most of our REM sleep is really in the second half of the night.
So what are some of the things that can interfere with this cycle and cause what I'm feeling right now? What are some of the things that can interrupt it? Yeah.
Well, number one for most people is going to be stress. And obviously stress makes it difficult to fall asleep, especially if you're lying in bed thinking about things. What people don't realize, though, is that that stress can follow you into sleep so that then it's keeping you from getting into those deeper stages of sleep, maybe fragmenting your sleep over the course of the night. So stress is by far the number one reason for disrupted sleep in most people.
That's fascinating. So when we say my thoughts are keeping me up or my mind is racing, that's real.
Absolutely. I always say where I'm going to get rich is to find a way to put light switches in the back of people's heads so that at night they could just flip the switch off and turn off their thoughts. And I've had lots of people tell me they would be willing to live the rest of their life with a light switch out the back of their head if they could just do that.
Do that. I want to bring in a caller. Benny is on the line and has a question about sleep paralysis. Mm.
Hey, how are you, sir? Listen, I have these recurrent dreams, and in the dreams, I can't move, and I attempt to wake myself up, and I'm trying to wake myself up, and I find myself opening my eyes, and I can't move, and so I'm trying to get out of the I've tried to get out of the bed in my sleep. And it's, I've fallen out of the bed two or three times. Wow. I woke up a month ago. When I opened my eyes, my feet were on the floor. And it's happened more than once, more than 10, probably about 15 or 20 times in the past few years.
Thank you, Benny.
Thank you so much for describing that. So do you know what Benny is describing and what potential solutions might be?
Yeah, it's actually not as unusual as you might think to have these types of experiences. One of the more unusual aspects of when we're in our rapid eye movement or REM sleep is muscle paralysis. So most of the muscles of our body are paralyzed during REM sleep, which serves a very useful feature of it prevents us from acting out our dreams. There are people who fail to develop that paralysis, and they often injure themselves or their bed partners as a result. Now, what happens for some people is, and I think this is closer to what Benny's experiencing, is you wake up out of REM sleep, but that muscle paralysis does not immediately switch off. And so people will wake up unable to move, usually for just a fraction of a second or a couple of seconds. But it can be a very frightening experience for a lot of people. So it sounds like to a certain extent, Benny's experiencing that muscle paralysis, that sleep paralysis, but also that even while he's asleep, his mind is becoming aware of that paralysis to a certain extent, that the line between dreaming and wakefulness is blurred a bit.
I had an incident like that in college where I jumped out of bed and I could not see, couldn't move. Mm-hmm. And I was told by my doctor to just wait a few minutes. Don't just jump up that way. Sometimes it takes a little while for you to wake up. Is that sort of some people, is that the case with some people that, you know, they don't, it takes a little while for them to come out of that sleep cycle to fully being awake?
Yeah, absolutely. I always say, sleep and wakefulness are not necessarily an all or none phenomenon. I often say sleep and wakefulness is more like a dimmer switch than a light switch. And so you can be in a state where some people, they're not just going to immediately fully wake up. Yeah, it's going to take them a few minutes before their brain has fully reached wakefulness.
Let me reintroduce you. Our guest is Philip Gierman, a sleep psychologist and researcher at the University of Pennsylvania, and we are fielding your questions about sleep. We know you've got them. Uh-huh. Call us at 888-477-9499 or email us at studio2@whyy.org. We got an email from Helena who asks, how can she go back to sleep when she wakes up in the middle of the night? So you got to sleep once, but darn, maybe you had to go to the bathroom or those racing thoughts popped you awake and you can't get back to sleep again. What are the strategies?
Yeah. So we consider waking up 1 to 3 or so times per night to be completely normal as long as people are not having difficulty falling back to sleep. But when people are having a hard time falling back to sleep, and especially if they reach a point where they're lying there, and like you said, their mind is starting to turn on, they're starting to think about the fact that they can't sleep. Sleep is one of those things that the more we think about sleeping and the harder we try to sleep, the harder it is to actually do. Mm. And so when you reach that point where your mind's going and you're focusing on your sleep, the best thing at that point actually is to get up and get out of bed. Ideally, go to a whole nother room,
And it seems counterintuitive.
It does, absolutely. And in fact, when I tell people this, they say, but I'm going to actually lose sleep if I get out of bed. And that's not actually my experience. Often what people are doing is they're substituting frustrating tossing and turning with relaxing activities. Mm-hmm. And people often find when they get up and relax before returning to bed, overall they end up falling asleep faster or back to sleep faster than if they had just lied there. I would say lying in bed, tossing and turning just adds fuel to the fire.
Yeah. I want to bring in another question. This time from Paul. Paul says, what is the best food to eat before going to bed? Those midnight snackers, are there are foods that are good for you to go eat right before bed and others
maybe
that may no be not so good?
Maybe no food at all.
Exactly.
I get that question a lot, and there's very little research saying that certain particular foods are good or bad for sleep. We just don't have enough data to make specific recommendations. But what we do know is the timing of food is important in the sense that you don't want to eat a heavy meal and then hop into bed because, one, that food sitting in your stomach, it can make it hard to fall asleep. But then, two, when you do fall asleep, your digestion slows down, so it becomes more difficult to digest that food. However, you don't want to go to bed so hungry that you're lying there thinking about food instead of being able to sleep.
Stomach growling.
Yes.
Yeah.
So while you want to avoid a heavy meal close to bed, a light snack close to bedtime might be useful.
So we talked before about how you know when you've had a bad night's sleep because you can't really function the way you normally function the next day. And I think we're all familiar with that impact of bad sleep. But there are lifelong impacts of repeatedly not getting enough sleep. And that seems to be emerging. What does the research say about the sort of long horizon detriments of repeatedly not getting a good night's sleep?
So we're learning more and more about the negative consequences on our physical and mental health of not getting a good night of sleep. But I should also add the caveat that oftentimes the impact it has on people on a day-to-day basis is actually worse, because what I don't want to do is induce a lot of panic in people who are already having trouble sleeping, who now I'm saying, oh, how bad it's going to be if you don't get a good night of sleep. That daily impact is probably worse. But yes, indeed, there are long-term consequences. So people who experience chronic sleep disruption over years are at greater risk of developing problems with mood, with anxiety, even substance use disorders. There's some association with cardiovascular disease. And one of the hottest areas of research in the field right now is between the link between chronic sleep disturbance and risk for Alzheimer's disease. Mm.
Can we explore that a little further? Because you alluded to this. When you read about this, it is kind of alarming.
Mm-hmm.
What do we know and what do we not know? Like, let's be frank about what we truly do know about this link at this point.
Yeah. So a lot of it is correlational in nature. So we've known for decades that people who experience Alzheimer's or other dementias frequently have trouble sleeping. And it was thought that the arrow just went in that direction, that you develop dementia and that impacts your sleep. But what we're now understanding is that sleep actually plays a really important role for the clearing of what we call toxic waste products that build up during the day. So all of our organs, as part of normal metabolism, build up waste products. And in most of the body, we have lymph nodes or our lymphatic system to drain waste away. The brain consumes a huge amount of energy, but there's no lymph nodes in the brain. Mm-hmm. And so until about 6 or 7 years ago, it really wasn't understood how that waste was being cleared away, and we now understand that actually happens during sleep. So inadequate sleep can lead up to a buildup of these waste products, some of which are associated with dementia. And so we know there are these relationships. We know that sleep's important for good brain health. But I don't think the evidence is strong enough that we can say, yeah, like if you have 20 years of insomnia, you're going to develop dementia.
Right.
It's not that strong of a link.
Or here's the percentage chance.
Exactly.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And let me just reintroduce. We have Dr. Philip Gehrman, a sleep psychologist and researcher with the University of Pennsylvania here. We're talking about what it takes to have a good night's sleep and some of those sleep disorders. Are you having trouble sleeping or do you have questions? Call in or email us. Our number is 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. I want to expand on that question about Alzheimer's, because let's talk about mental health. Does lack of sleep, could it trigger mental health issues or make them worse.
Absolutely. And that's what a lot of my research is on that link between sleep and mental health. And we know there's a few different relationships that people can have. So when people develop mental health symptoms and they are feeling depressed or anxious, that mood or anxiety problems can disrupt sleep. We also know, like I said, the arrow goes the other way, that chronically not sleeping well can also increase your risk for developing new mental health problems. I think about it these days as chronic poor sleep applies pressure to your vulnerabilities. So if you are someone who's prone to anxiety, when you don't sleep well, that's probably what you're going to experience as a worsening of anxiety. If you are prone to difficulties reining in your impulses, well, that's going to be magnified by lack of sleep. So whatever your particular vulnerabilities are, sleep applies pressure to them.
One of the things that is so strange to me is the fact that we humans sleep in all sorts of different positions. Mm-hmm. Some of us sleep side, front, back. Alice emailed us and has a question about positions. She says she tends to have nightmares when she sleeps on her back. Mm. Is there a correlation? So I want you to answer that question specifically, mm-hmm. but maybe talk a little more generally about what we know about different sleep positions and different outcomes.
Mm-hmm. So there's a few factors that come into play with sleep position. The most important one is really just comfort. And so some people are comfortable sleeping on their back. Some people are comfortable sleeping on their side. And so you're going to sleep best in the most comfortable position. I know that's obvious, but I think it bears stating. Another factor is related to our breathing during sleep. Mm. And so we all have this tissue in our airway that relaxes when we sleep. And it can vibrate as we breathe in and out. And that's one of the most common causes of snoring, is vibration of this tissue. But when we sleep on our back, the force of gravity actually can pull that tissue down into our airway and can partially or completely block our airway, which is the most common form of a sleep disorder called obstructive sleep apnea. Mm. And so when people have a kind of predisposition towards sleep apnea, it tends to be worse at its worst when we sleep on our back.
Interesting. Yeah. And could that somehow then be related to nightmares or thoughts in your head?
It actually could, because when we are in our REM sleep, our breathing is irregular. So people who have sleep apnea, their apnea tends to be at its worst during REM sleep. So if you combine sleeping on your back, which may worsen this breathing, with REM sleep, what can happen is it can really kind of give you this choppy, fragmented REM sleep, which potentially can trigger nightmares.
Yeah, and I want to follow up kind of, I think, that is linked to what you just said, is from Lou, one of our listeners, who writes in his email, I don't have trouble sleeping, but I don't feel rested after my sleep. Why might that be?
Yeah, I feel like we've developed an almost obsessive focus on the quantity of sleep that we get. We don't pay enough attention to the quality of the sleep that we're getting, because we can sleep 8 to 9 hours per night, but if it's poor quality sleep, we're still not going to feel rested the next day, as Liz describing so eloquently. And there's a number of things that can disrupt the quality of sleep. It can be things such as, you know, the stress or things that are disrupting the sleep stages. It could be for some people, it's an indication that maybe they do have an undiagnosed sleep disorder that's disrupting the quality of sleep. So it's certainly something worth talking with your healthcare provider about.
Okay. I don't know if there's any way to answer this question, but it is a burning question for me. I have always wondered how much of our frayed relationship with sleep is linked specifically to modern life. Mm. We have electricity, lights, screens. You know, we have these daily schedules where we might have to get up at 6 a.m. to go to our job or stay up at the job until 12 o'clock. And I'm imagining like 1,000, 2,000 years ago, a lot of these things didn't really exist. We were just like more in tune with the setting and rising of the sun. Did people sleep better in the past? Do we have any way of knowing that? And do we know how much of our like current predicament is linked to modern society? I know it's a huge question. It's just so fascinating to me.
Yeah, it is a great question. And we don't know a lot about what people's sleep was back like hundreds or thousands of years ago. One area of research that's been done is to look at what's been called biphasic sleep. And so if you look at people's writings from, you know, the Middle Ages up until about late 1800s, people would make reference to what they called first and second sleep. So it seems that again, people would go to bed when the sun went down or shortly after. They'd have a three to five hour period of sleep. Then they'd have a period of wakefulness in the middle of the night, which was just normal. And then they'd settle down into the second sleep. And you see mention of this start to disappear when electric lighting becomes available.
You're blowing my mind right now.
Yeah.
And now everyone then assumes, well, then therefore biphasic sleep must be better for you. And we don't have any data to support that. But it does suggest that we may have slept differently.
Wow. Yeah. And I want to ask you a couple of remedies because I've been struggling with insomnia off and on for years. And one of the things that I found now is I take CBD mm-hmm. at night on days when I can't rest, and it helps me rest. And I want to bring in Mary's question and wrap that into potential remedies. Mm-hmm. Mary wrote that she heard extra virgin olive oil daily might help in the brain cleaning process during sleep. Thought your thoughts on that, and then any other remedies to kind of help with that process of resting and also clearing your brain.
Yeah, I always feel like I've heard all the suggestions of things
you
take.
Olive oil?
The olive oil is a new one for me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Does anything work though? Are there like legit things that work?
So the problem is we just don't know.
Okay. Mm.
I mean, there's lots of research on like prescription sleep medications, but when it gets to all these more home remedies, I should say the sleep research field, it's not a huge field. And so there's so many unanswered research questions that we have. What I can say, though, is that what is helpful for people is routines. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have a young infant at home and you know, when parents of young children are often told you want to develop nighttime bedtime routines with kids and, you know, take them up at a certain time of not consistent time of night, have certain books that you just read at night, because when you establish those routines, you start the routine and it begins to signal to the brain that bedtime is approaching. Well, as adults, we benefit from routines as well. And so, for example, if someone's going to have their olive oil or they're going to have that chamomile tea at night or use, you know, the lavender oil, the actual effect of any one of those things might be very small to none. But if that's your routine, you build that routine. Mm. And then as you do that on a nightly basis, as you begin the routine, it's sending those cues to the brain that sleep time is coming.
So it's sort of that subtle cue to yourself.
Exactly.
Okay, but Susan and Derek have questions, though, about sleep medications.
Mm-hmm.
And there are prescribed sleep medications. We're not talking about home remedies here. When Susan asks, is medication justified? And Derek also wants to know, do sleeping pills actually work? Is there any evidence on when it's justified and if they work?
Yeah. I'll actually start with the second question because I think that's a good starting point. Is they do work on average, otherwise they would not be approved by the FDA. But the average effect is quite small because there are some people who get quite significant benefit from them and other people who get very little benefit. Uh-huh. So there is a lot of variability from person to person.
So the average is small.
Exactly. Exactly. And what a lot of my patients will tell me is they'll say, I sleep better when I take my medication, but I still don't sleep great. That's a typical comment that I hear. In terms of when they're appropriate, is they're generally recommended for short-term use, and short-term meaning like a month or less. And I'm fully aware that there's probably a lot of listeners who have been taking medications for years and years and getting good benefit from them. We just don't know a lot about the long-term safety of sleeping medications. And also that they often just aren't really fixing the underlying problem. They're more covering it up. So it's generally recommended for short-term use.
Interesting. Interesting. We have a bunch of questions we're not going to get to, unfortunately, maybe for another show. But that is Philip Gierman, a sleep psychologist and researcher at the University of Pennsylvania, where he directs the Sleep, Neurobiology, and Psychopathology Research Lab. Philip, thank you so much for joining us today on Studio 2. It was fascinating.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate you being here. And coming up, Mr. Trombone, Jeff Bradshaw, will be in the studio. Some live music for your Tuesday afternoon. Our very first time having live music on Studio 2. Are you excited, Avi?
That'll keep you up. I'm very excited. Mr. Trombone coming up on Studio 2.
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Studio 2, everybody. I'm Avi Wolfman-Eric.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Our next guest, it is an award-winning musician born and raised in Philly who went from no formal training on the trombone to touring with international stars for the last two decades. Jeff Bradshaw is his name. His forthcoming album is Jeff Bradshaw 20. And he's here in the studio right now to play that gorgeous trombone and talk with Avi and me. Jeff Bradshaw, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I had a different question lined up to start, Jeff, but I'm curious about the trombone itself. Is that your 1A trombone? Do you have a whole series of them? Because this is a beautiful instrument right
here. Thank you. I have a bunch of trombones, gifts and prototypes from different companies, but this is my King 4B Silver Sonic. She's a one of a kind. Her name is Silver, and she was customly designed by Brett Gustafson and Naja. They put all these African hammered markings and engravings on it. She is a one of a kind. She
gorgeous.
Was born in 1991.
1991. 30. That's over 30 years old.
She's been with me since then.
Wow.
Since
so you've been blowing that horn for so long. You started playing a brass horn in an old church in North Philly,
yes.
And it became the main attraction for the church. And then you eventually found and fell in love with the trombone. What is it about that instrument that has held your love for so many years, decades at this point?
First of all, the instrument was played in the United House of Prayer for All People, where the churches I was born and raised in with my parents, where the gospel brass bands are the feature in the music ministry. My father was he was the youth minister, but he's also the leader of the band. My father played trombone. The late Norman Bradshaw was the coolest man, the coolest, flyest man, the most charismatic man to ever walk the face of the earth. Mm. So if my father played trombone, whatever he did, I just wanted to do it because he was a superhero to me. He was just amazing. He lit up rooms when he walked into them, and he was amazingly talented. He could play guitar, trumpet, sousaphone, tuba, but trombone was like his main instrument. And because he played it, and he played it the way he did, I looked up to him. So I just wanted to be like him.
Wow.
I just wanted to be like my dad. And he was an amazing man, and it made me want to be amazing on this instrument. And I think we're off to a good start.
Yeah, pretty good. They call you Mr. Trombone. Yeah,
you must
Jill
be doing
Scott
that.
Jill Scott gave me that.
Oh, really?
Name.
Yeah.
Really?
Jill Scott gave
was
me
that.
Was
like
that
in a conversation, or how did that happen?
On stage at a concert.
Just called you Mr. Trombone.
Yeah.
Matter of fact,
that's, she gave me the name when we did my first single off the first album, Bone Deep. It's called Slide. But she gave me the name, you know, Mr. Trombone, in the video, on the song. And that's when the name was born. Like people, a lot of people give themselves names. Jill Scott gave me that name.
That's good. It's an organic nickname. I like that.
I like that. So
you mentioned you grew up in the church, and that was a big musical inspiration for you. How do you hear that? How would we hear that in your music today?
Because of the way I was learned, the way I was taught.
Mm.
My father taught me to play the words. I learned most people, all formerly trained musicians learn to play by scales, the scales on piano, on every instrument, especially on trombone, the seven positions. I didn't learn to play trombone that way. Not from the beginning. I learned to play trombone. My father let me hear gospel songs, old gospel hymns, and he taught me to learn the words of the songs. So that's where my lyrical style of playing trombone came from. I'm not playing the trombone. I'm singing the trombone.
And that's a perfect transition,
yeah, I
think, to for you to perform a little bit for us.
Oh.
I understand you're going to play a little bit of Carrie's Bread Pudding.
Oh.
And let us hear some of these words on the trombone.
Okay.
So this song is called Carrie's Bread Pudding. And can you explain briefly the title?
Carrie Bradshaw is my mother.
Mm-hmm.
Born in Aiken, South Carolina. pick cotton from the age of 8 to 13, came to Philadelphia, met my father in high school, sweethearts. They were married for 49 years until my father passed away in 2011. She is a walking national treasure. She's known for her famous bread pudding that she still sells in her church in United House of Prayer every Sunday. Oh. It's famous. It is incredible. You have to get Carrie's bread pudding. At 83 years old, there was no way I wasn't going to celebrate my mother on this 20th anniversary album.
All right, so
she's
my
hero.
We're going to hear a little bit of the song, Carrie's Bread Pudding. Take it away, Mr. Trombone.
Let's get it.
That's how you know it's good.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Got a little bump finger snapping on Studio 2 right now.
Trombone.
Wow. Beautiful.
Well, I'll let you catch your breath for a second. We do have a couple more minutes, though. And I did want to ask you if you think the trombone is misunderstood or misperceived by people, and if so, how?
If people, is it misunderstood? Misunderstood. I don't know. I think because we've had so many greats play the instrument, from Fred Wesley to J.J. Johnson, you know, Slide Hampton, Curtis Fuller, Wycliffe Gordon, many jazz greats have played this instrument. And now me and my brother, Trombone Shorty, him on the rock soul side and me on the R&B, you know, smooth jazz hip hop side, you know, we're giving the trombone a new face.
Yeah.
You know, we're giving the trombone a new sound. You know, people can now, younger kids can now, when they come up behind us, you know, you don't actually have to grab a saxophone or a trumpet or a piano or a guitar. You know, trombone will be the new it thing and lead music on mainstream music, you know, and that's what I'm trying to do. I'm just trying to kick down the doors of mainstream media and music with this instrument on the soul R&B hip hop side.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I want to give you a chance to talk about Jeff Bradshaw 20. It comes out in just a few weeks. Tell us about the inspiration for this album as we get ready to wrap up.
2003, November 4th, 2003, Bone Deep, my first album when I was signed to Michael Jordan's label, Hidden Beach Recordings, signed by Steve McKeever. It was my first baby. It was the first time that somebody had signed a trombone player in mainstream music in many, 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 many years. That was my baby. What an amazing album it was. It's still one of my favorite albums out of now, which will be 5. Jeff Bradshaw 20 is the culmination of that album. It's the 20-year anniversary of my first album. I'm still here. I'm still relevant, working with artists like Raheem Devon, Eric Roberson, Liz Vaughn, Saint Ezekiel. I cover everything on this album. It is the best music of my career.
Ooh, now that's a tease. And that is it for us today on our show.
Yes.
Head on over to whyy.org/studio2. Follow us, WHYY, on Twitter. We use the hashtag Studio2.
And our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Our engineer today is Al Banks from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. We are leaving you this hour with Jeff's other single just released, Make Some Time, featuring Eric Roberson. Thank you so much for joining us today on Studio 2.